Ever try to like sketch out a business deal, on like a cocktail napkin? You just jot down some key points and maybe shake hands and feel like you're good to go.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you want it. That's kind of what happened in this case, Roberson v. Volvo. Except instead of a napkin, we're talking about a 572-word email.
Wow.
And the stakes were a bit higher,
Okay.
like $84
Oh,
million.
wow.
So to help us break down this case, I've got an expert here with me today.
Hi.
So what's so fascinating about this case, in the email,
Yeah.
can email really be a contract?
Well, that's what's so interesting about this case. It really highlights that sometimes blurry line between just preliminary negotiations and a legally binding contract. And so we have PFT Roberson, which is this big trucking company that really needed to replace their whole fleet, like urgently. And they start talking to Volvo about this huge deal. But as we're going to find out, things got really complicated when it came down to figuring out if they actually had a contract.
So we've got this email that was sent from Volvo to Roberson. It was on December 6th, and it outlined some of the terms they discussed.
Right.
I mean, you would think that an email that long
Yeah.
would have to be a contract, right?
Well, you would think so, but it's not really the length that matters. It's the content and the intent. One of the things that the court really focused on was this concept of intent to be bound. So basically, did both parties actually act like they had a final agreement? And in this case, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said no.
Why not? Didn't they at least agree on some of the terms in the email?
They did agree on some.
Yeah.
But the email actually listed several terms as still needing to be like reviewed and finalized. They even used the phrase required details when they were talking about some of these open issues. And the court saw this as a pretty clear signal that they didn't intend for the email to be like the final word. They were anticipating a more formal and comprehensive contract later on.
So it's not enough to just have some terms that you've agreed on.
Right.
You need that clear intention to be bound by what's been written.
Yeah, exactly. Think of it this way. Imagine you're discussing like a potential project with a client. You might like toss around some ideas, maybe even like ballpark a price. But that doesn't mean you actually have a contract. You haven't actually committed to doing the work yet.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So what happened after that December 6th email? Did they just stop negotiating and assume they had a deal?
No, not at all. That's actually another key point that the court highlighted.
Okay.
Roberson and Volvo continued to negotiate for 2 whole months after that email. They
Wow.
were going back and forth on things like the price per truck, the cost of maintaining the older vehicles, and terms of the exit clause. The court saw this continued negotiation as evidence that neither party actually believed that they had a finalized contract.
So it's almost like the email was more of a progress report than a done deal. And the court picked up on that.
Right.
But what about the jury? Didn't they initially side with Roberson?
Yeah, you're right. A jury did award Roberson over $5 million in damages for breach of contract. But, you know, juries decide facts, not the law. So the Seventh Circuit overturned that verdict, basically saying, look, the email itself, combined with like their actions after that, make it clear that this wasn't a final agreement. They even quoted the Illinois Supreme Court stating that the law demands a manifestation of agreement and a mere mental assent or determination to accept an offer not communicated to the offerer is insufficient.
So even though a jury thought there was a contract, the appeals court took a much closer look at the details
Yeah.
and came to a different conclusion.
Yeah.
What does all this mean for lawyers who are drafting up deals? What are like the key takeaways here?
I think the biggest lesson is to be incredibly precise with your language and to make your intentions crystal clear. So use phrases like subject to contract or non-binding if you're still in that negotiation phase.
So sprinkle those magic phrases throughout your drafts, like legal fairy dust.
Exactly. It's all about managing expectations and avoiding those misunderstandings.
Right.
You're clearly signaling that you're still hammering out those details and that this isn't the final word.
Okay, so clear labeling is crucial.
Yes.
What else should lawyers keep in mind?
I think this case also highlights how important it is to document each stage of the negotiation really meticulously.
Okay.
You want to be able to demonstrate clearly how the agreement kind of evolved and show how the party's understanding evolved over time.
So it's like creating a timeline of the negotiation.
Yeah.
Making sure everyone is on the same page about what's been agreed to and what's still up in the air.
Exactly. And this is especially important in complex deals with like lots of moving parts.
Right.
Like we have with the fleet agreement in Robertson v. Volvo.
Right.
You don't want to end up in a situation where a piecemeal agreement or a preliminary email is mistaken for the final binding contract.
It sounds like this case is like a masterclass in risk management.
Yeah.
You've got to be incredibly careful with your words and your actions, especially when millions of dollars are on the line.
Absolutely. And it really underscores the need for experienced legal counsel who can not only draft airtight agreements,
right,
but also like guide you through the whole negotiation process, anticipate potential pitfalls, and ensure that your interests are protected every step of the way.
This has been incredibly insightful. I feel like I'm already starting to look at emails and negotiations with a more critical eye.
That's the goal.
So speaking of looking closely, let's dive into the court's reasoning a bit more.
Okay.
What were the specific factors that led them to rule in favor of Volvo? What were they looking for when they analyzed that December 6th email?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Let's break it down. First, we've already talked about the language of the email itself.
Right.
What specifically tipped the scales in Volvo's favor? Was it just the fact that they listed some terms as required details?
Right.
That was definitely a key factor, but it goes beyond just listing like missing terms.
Okay.
It's about how those terms were described and the overall tone of the email.
Right.
The court zeroed in on phrases like still under review and need to be finalized, which really strongly suggested that the parties were anticipating a more formal agreement later on.
So it's like they were leaving a trail of breadcrumbs, hinting that this wasn't the be-all and end-all of their agreement.
Precisely. They were basically saying, we're still working on this, and we'll let you know when we have something concrete.
Hmm.
And remember, the court even quoted that case law saying that just a mental assent isn't enough to create a contract.
Right.
You need that clear outward manifestation of agreement.
Okay, so it's not just about what's in your head, it's about what you communicate to the other party.
Right.
And in this case, Volvo's communication in that email clearly indicated that they weren't ready to be bound by those terms alone.
Exactly. Now let's move on to the second area the court considered.
Okay.
The post-email conduct. What do you think was so significant about the fact that Robertson and Volvo kept negotiating for 2 months after that December 6th email?
Well, it seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? I mean, if they truly believed they had a contract, why would they need to keep hammering out the details?
Exactly. The court saw this ongoing back and forth as strong evidence that neither party viewed the email as like a final binding agreement.
Right.
They were still trying to reach a consensus on those like crucial missing elements. It's like saying, hey, we have a deal.
Right.
And then proceeding to spend the next 2 months arguing over the fine print.
Yeah.
The court saw right through that.
So the court was essentially saying actions speak louder than words.
Yeah.
Even if that email had sounded more definitive, their subsequent conduct would have undermined that.
Precisely. And this leads to the third and final area that the court considered.
Okay.
Illinois law.
How do you think the legal landscape in Illinois played into their decision? Well, I know that different states have slightly different approaches to contract law.
Right.
What's unique about Illinois?
Illinois courts tend to follow this idea of a definitive document rule. What does that mean in plain English? They're very reluctant to enforce agreements that are clearly meant to be formalized later on in like a more comprehensive signed contract.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it like buying a house.
Okay.
You might have a preliminary offer and acceptance, but everyone knows that the real deal is sealed with that final detailed purchase agreement.
So it's like the court is saying, hey, if you're planning to draw up a big official contract anyway, we're not going to treat these earlier exchanges as binding.
That's a great way to put it. And in Robertson v. Volvo, the fact that the email itself alluded to a future formal agreement,
right,
combined with the continued negotiations afterward, made it clear that a definitive document was indeed expected.
Yeah.
The court wasn't going to jump the gun and enforce an incomplete agreement when it was obvious that both parties intended to create a more comprehensive contract later.
So in a way, this definitive document rule kind of protects both parties.
Yeah.
It prevents them from being locked into an agreement that's not fully baked.
Right.
While also ensuring that their intentions are respected when they clearly signal that they're aiming for a more formal agreement.
Exactly. It strikes that balance between flexibility and certainty.
Yeah.
And in this case, it ultimately worked in Volvo's favor.
This has been incredibly illuminating. We've gone from a seemingly simple email exchange to a deep dive into the nuances of contract formation and the legal reasoning behind the Seventh Circuit's decision.
Yeah.
But before we wrap up this part of our discussion, I want to touch on one more aspect of the case that I find particularly intriguing.
Oh, I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
The court was very clear that just because parties agree on some terms, it doesn't mean they have a contract for those specific terms.
Uh-huh.
Especially in a complex deal like this.
Right.
They emphasized that it was all part of a larger whole.
Yes.
It wasn't a series of mini contracts.
You're talking about the concept of partial agreements.
Right.
That's a really important takeaway from this case.
Yeah.
Even if they'd nailed down the exact price per truck in that December 6th email.
Right.
It wouldn't have necessarily meant that they had a contract for those trucks.
Right.
If other key elements like the maintenance costs and the exit clause were still up in the air.
So you can't just cherry pick the parts you like and declare victory.
Exactly.
You need agreement on all the essential terms for a contract to be enforceable.
Exactly. The court made this great analogy to a jigsaw puzzle.
Okay.
You might have some of the pieces in place, but until you've got the whole picture, you can't say you've completed the puzzle.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
It perfectly captures the idea that a contract is more than just the sum of its parts.
Uh-huh.
It's about the overall agreement, the meeting of the minds, and the clear intent to be bound by, like, a complete and comprehensive set of terms.
And that's precisely what was missing in Roberson v. Volvo. The court saw through the partial agreement, recognized those ambiguities, and ultimately sided with Volvo, preventing them from being locked into a deal that wasn't fully formed.
Wow. We've covered a lot of ground here. We've dissected that infamous December 6th email, explored the concept of intent to be bound, and delved into the definitive document rule.
Yeah, we have.
And we've learned that even a casual email exchange can turn into a legal battleground if you're not careful about your words and your actions.
That's for sure.
So the next time you're hammering out a deal, think of Roberson v. Volvo
and
maybe put it in writing.
Yeah, good advice.
Join us for part two of this deep dive as we explore some fascinating hypothetical scenarios that will really test your understanding of contract law. Welcome back to our deep dive into Roberson v. Volvo.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm feeling a lot more cautious about my inbox after that last segment.
I bet.
But beyond just like avoiding lawsuits, are there any broader lessons we can take away from this case? Things that apply to anyone who negotiates deals? Not just lawyers drafting formal contracts.
Absolutely. The principles at play in Roberson v. Volvo have implications for like any kind of negotiation, whether you're buying a car, hiring a contractor,
sure,
or even just figuring out who's doing dishes tonight.
Right.
It all boils down to clear communication.
Okay.
And understanding the difference between a casual conversation and an actual commitment.
Okay. So let's say I'm not dealing with million-dollar truck fleets.
Right.
How can I apply the intent to be bound concept to my everyday negotiations? Like if I'm emailing with a potential client about a project,
yeah,
how do I avoid accidentally creating a contract before I'm ready?
That's a great question. And it's something that a lot of freelancers and small business owners struggle with.
Right.
Remember, the court in Roberson v. Volvo was really looking for evidence that both parties were acting as if they had a final agreement.
Right.
So in your emails, you know, use language that makes it really clear that you're still kind of exploring possibilities.
Okay, so instead of saying, we'll build you a website for $5,000.
Right.
Which sounds pretty definitive.
Right.
I might see something like,
yeah,
we're estimating the cost of your website project to be around $5,000, but we'll provide a detailed quote once we finalize the scope of work.
Exactly. You're setting those expectations, indicating that things are still subject to change.
Okay.
And most importantly, you're not making like a firm offer.
Right.
That could be construed as binding.
It's like that subject to contract fairy dust you mentioned earlier. I'm going to start sprinkling that everywhere.
A wise move.
Now, let's say you've been going back and forth with a client.
Okay.
And you think you're pretty close to a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You've emailed them a summary of the terms that you've discussed.
Right.
What's like a critical step to take at that point, thinking about what happened with Roberson and Volvo?
That's a really good point to bring up. Based on what we've learned, I would say it's crucial to make it absolutely crystal clear whether that email summary is meant to be the final agreement or if it's just a stepping stone to like a more formal contract. You want to avoid any ambiguity that could lead to misunderstandings later on.
Right.
You could say something like, please review these terms carefully. If everything looks good, we'll move forward with drafting a formal contract for both parties to sign.
Okay.
This really leaves no doubt about your intentions.
Right.
And the next steps.
So even if I'm not dealing with multi-million dollar agreements.
Right.
That meticulous documentation we talked about earlier is still super important.
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to be complicated.
Okay.
It could be as simple as adding a note to your email saying, this is just a summary of our discussion so far, not a binding agreement.
Got it.
Think of it as leaving a breadcrumb trail of your negotiation.
Right.
So that everyone is clear on where they stand at each point.
That's a great point, especially in today's world where so much communication happens digitally.
Uh-huh.
It's so easy for messages to get lost or misinterpreted or even deliberately taken out of context.
Yeah, you've hit on a crucial issue. The digital landscape adds another layer of complexity to this whole idea of contract formation.
Hmm.
Remember our hypothetical from earlier about whether like a series of text messages could constitute a contract?
Yeah.
That's something that courts are grappling with more and more.
Because text messages are so informal, it's easy to forget that they can still have legal weight.
Right.
I'm guessing the same principles apply though, right?
Yeah.
In clear offers and acceptance, evidence of a meeting of the minds.
Yep.
It's all there, just in digital form.
Exactly. The medium might be different.
Right.
But those fundamental principles of contract law remain remarkably consistent.
Yeah.
The challenge is applying those principles to like this world of emojis and abbreviations and disappearing messages.
Right. So in a way, Roberson v. Volvo feels incredibly relevant, even though it involved like a very specific set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder that clear communication is paramount.
Yeah.
No matter how you're communicating.
It is.
And documentation is key, especially when dealing with digital platforms.
Right.
Screenshot those text conversations.
Yeah.
Save those emails. Mm-hmm. Keep a record of online agreements.
Okay.
It might feel like overkill, but you never know when that digital breadcrumb trail might become crucial.
So true.
It's like, I'm seeing the legal implications lurking behind every send button now.
I know, me too.
But beyond just like being cautious.
Right.
Are there any proactive things that people can do to protect themselves in this like digital negotiation world?
One of the best things you can do is just invest in clear, well-written contracts for your business.
Okay.
Even if you're not a lawyer yourself.
Right.
There are tons of templates and resources available online that can help you create legally sound agreements.
So let's say I'm a freelancer.
Okay.
And I want to make sure that I'm covered when I take on a new client.
Uh-huh.
Is there a specific type of contract I should be using?
Yeah, you'd want like a solid freelance contract.
Okay.
That really clearly outlines things like the scope of work payment terms, deadlines, intellectual property rights, and any other relevant details that are specific to your industry.
And having that contract in place up front,
yes,
before I start the work, protects me from those misunderstandings and potential disputes later on.
Exactly. It sets those clear expectations from the outset.
Okay.
And provides a legal framework for the entire relationship.
That makes sense. Yeah. I'm also thinking about those click wrap agreements.
Oh, yeah.
We all encounter online. You know the ones where you scroll through like pages of dense legalese?
Right.
Before clicking, I agree, without actually reading anything. We've all been there.
I know we have.
Is there anything we can do to be more savvy about those?
Click wrap agreements are like a whole other beast.
Okay.
And they often raise questions about fairness.
Right.
And whether users really have a chance to understand what they're actually agreeing to.
Yeah, because let's be honest, who has time to read through all that fine print?
You're right, most people don't. But legally speaking, ignorance is not a defense.
Hmm.
The law generally presumes that if you click, I agree, you've agreed to those terms,
wow,
whether you actually read them or not.
Okay.
That said, there has been some pushback against this idea, with some courts taking a more consumer-friendly approach, especially when the terms are particularly unfair or deceptive.
So it's worth at least skimming those terms, even if I don't understand every legal nuance.
Right.
And if something seems fishy or outrageous, I might want to think twice before clicking. I agree.
Absolutely. And if you're a business and you're using click agreements, you know, be mindful of transparency and fairness.
Right.
Make sure those terms are really clear, concise, and readily accessible to your users.
Right.
Don't bury crucial information in like pages of legal jargon.
Yeah.
It's not just about protecting yourself legally. Right. It's also about maintaining that trust with your customers.
So transparency is key, whether we're talking about million-dollar fleet agreements or clicking I agree on a website.
Exactly. And it circles back to what we discussed earlier about the importance of that clear communication and that meeting of the minds.
Right.
Whether you're negotiating in person over email or through like a digital platform, just make sure everyone's on the same page.
Yeah.
About the terms, the intentions, the expectations.
And if you're ever in doubt, consult with an experienced lawyer.
Yes.
They can help you navigate those complexities of contract law and ensure that your agreements are legally sound.
That's a great point. To end on legal counsel can be invaluable.
Right.
Not just for drafting contracts,
right.
but also just for understanding the legal implications of your actions in like this rapidly evolving digital world.
Yeah. This has been such an insightful conversation.
I agree.
I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the complexities of contract law.
Yeah.
And how it applies to our everyday lives.
Uh-huh.
But we've only scratched the surface so far. Join us for the final part of this deep dive, where we'll explore even more hypothetical scenarios.
Sounds good.
And consider how technology is continuing to reshape the legal landscape. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been unpacking the case of Roberson v. Volvo, exploring the nuances of contracts, and how even a casual email can have serious legal consequences.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating discussion.
It has. We've talked about clear communication, meticulous documentation, and the importance of understanding intent when it comes to forming a contract. But as we kind of hinted at the end of part two,
right,
technology keeps throwing these new challenges our way.
It does, and never stops.
And it's not just about those pesky click wrap agreements, right?
No.
The way we communicate and do business is constantly evolving.
Definitely.
Deals are being struck through text messages, social media, online platforms. It's a whole new world out there.
It is. And it's fascinating to see how these new communication methods are kind of pushing the boundaries of traditional contract law.
Let's dive into some specific examples. Say I'm a freelance designer and I agree to take on a project based on a series of direct messages on a platform like Instagram. We look at the scope, the timeline, even the price. But later on, there's a dispute. Could those messages be considered a binding contract?
That's a great question, and it's one that courts are increasingly having to address. It all comes back to those fundamental principles we've been discussing.
Okay.
Offer acceptance, consideration, and intent to be bound.
So even though it's happening on Instagram, a platform primarily designed for sharing photos and videos, the same legal standards apply.
Exactly. The court would analyze those messages just as they would emails or written letters.
Yeah.
Was there a clear offer outlining the terms of the project? Did the designer accept those terms? Was there an exchange of value? In this case, the design work for payment. And most importantly, did both parties act as though they had a final binding agreement?
So those heart emojis and thumbs up reactions could actually carry legal weight.
It's possible. The court would look at the context the language used and any subsequent actions that might indicate whether both parties intended to form a contract.
Wow. It's like every send button has suddenly become a miniature gavel. It makes you realize how important it is to be mindful of what you're saying and how you're saying it, even in those casual online interactions.
I agree. And this is where documentation becomes absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
In a world of disappearing messages and ephemeral content, having a record of those conversations can be essential if a dispute arises.
So screenshot those Instagram DMs. Save those text messages, and even keep a log of those late-night Slack chats where you might have hammered out a deal.
Precisely. It might seem like overkill, but it's all about creating that digital paper trail, protecting yourself, and ensuring that you can provide evidence of the agreement if needed.
It's almost like we need a new etiquette for digital communication, one that acknowledges the potential legal implications lurking behind every post and message.
I think you're right. We need to be more mindful of the fact that even seemingly casual online interactions can have legal consequences, especially when money or services are involved.
And it's not just about individuals. Businesses are also having to adapt to this new landscape. We've talked about click wrap agreements, but what about the terms of service for online platforms and apps? Those are often lengthy and complex, and most people probably just scroll through them without really understanding what they're agreeing to.
It's a valid concern. Those terms of service are essentially contracts, and they govern our use of those platforms. While they might seem daunting, it's important to at least be aware of the key provisions, especially those related to data privacy, intellectual property, and dispute resolution.
So while it's probably unrealistic to expect everyone to become legal experts, it's worth taking the time to familiarize yourself with the basic terms that govern your online interactions. And if you're a business, make sure your terms of service are clear, concise, and readily accessible to users.
Absolutely. Transparency is key. Don't bury crucial information in pages of legal jargon. Make it easy for users to understand what they're agreeing to. It's not just about legal compliance. It's about building trust and fostering a positive relationship with your users.
We've talked a lot about the challenges of contract formation in the digital age, but are there any positive developments? Has technology offered any solutions to these issues?
There are some exciting innovations emerging. Blockchain technology, for example, has the potential to really revolutionize contract law.
Okay.
Smart contracts, which are essentially self-executing agreements stored on a blockchain, could really streamline the contracting process, reduce ambiguity, and even automate certain aspects of contract enforcement.
So imagine a world where contracts are not only digital, but also tamper-proof and automatically enforced. That would certainly change the game.
It would. Of course, there are still legal and practical challenges to overcome, but the potential of blockchain technology in this space is undeniable. It's one of the many ways that technology is shaping the future of law.
This has been an incredible journey through the world of contract law. We've gone from a seemingly simple email exchange in Robertson v. Volvo to a deep dive into the digital frontier of contract formation. We've explored how technology is challenging those traditional notions of offer acceptance and intent to be bound, and we've considered the implications for both individuals and businesses.
It's been quite a ride.
It has. We've learned that even in the age of emojis and instant messaging, clear communication, meticulous documentation, and a solid understanding of those basic contract principles are more important than ever.
I completely agree.
And if you're ever in doubt, don't hesitate to seek legal counsel.
Good advice.
A good lawyer can not only help you navigate the complexities of contract law, but also anticipate potential pitfalls and ensure that your agreements are legally sound and aligned with your business goals.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Robertson v. Volvo, let me leave you with this thought. Contract law is a dynamic and ever-evolving field, one that's increasingly intertwined with technology. By staying informed, being proactive, and seeking expert advice when needed, you can confidently navigate this complex landscape and ensure that your agreements are both legally sound and mutually beneficial.
Well said. I think that's a great takeaway for our listeners.
Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We hope this episode has provided valuable insights into the fascinating world of contract law and its implications in the digital age. Until next time, remember to be mindful of your digital footprint and contract with confidence.